Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. We are recording this in early February 2022 at a time of escalating tensions in Eastern Europe, focused along the border of Russia with Ukraine. And Dominic, it's fascinating, isn't it, if you have any interest in early medieval history, because last summer, Vladimir Putin, or at least someone pretending to be Vladimir Putin, wrote an essay about the historical background to this.
5,000 words, Tom, I think it was.
5,000 words. And he went back, obviously, through the history of the Soviet Union, back through the emergence of the Russian Empire. But he ended up going all the way back to the 10th century and the emergence of the Kingdom of the Rus. Yeah. Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, Vladimir Putin, I put that slightly in inverted commas, wrote, are all descendants of ancient Rus, which was the largest state in Europe. Slavic and other tribes across the vast territory were bound together by one language, economic ties, the rule of the princes of the Rurik dynasty, and after the baptism of the Rus, the Orthodox faith. And I guess two things leap out from that. One is Putin's argument that because there was this great empire, this great kingdom of the Rus, covering a vast expanse of territory, therefore everybody who was, lives in lands that constituted that kingdom properly should be part of Russia, I guess, is the kind of implicit argument. And the other argument is it's one from Silence, where he talks about Slavic and other tribes, but he notably does not mention anyone coming from Scandinavia, which is very much the sense that I have, that the foundations of the Rus kingdom, this kind of emergent kingdom in what becomes Russia and Ukraine, were actually Vikings.
Well, this is a massively controversial issue, isn't it, Tom? So this week's subject is the Vikings in the East, which is this impossibly kind of romantic, violent, exotic, exciting, murky subject, but it's also politically very controversial. So in the Soviet Union, there were massive arguments, and there was a sort of the real movement in the Soviet Union to say that basically, okay, there were some Scandinavians, i.e. Vikings, there, but they weren't very important, and their cultural imprint was soon kind of, buried by Slavic traditions and Slavic culture. And we don't owe anything to these Scandinavians, basically.
Yeah, so as I understand it, that argument first developed in the 18th century against the backdrop of Peter the Great's kind of defeat of the Swedes.
Yeah.
So obviously the Russians then didn't want to think that the foundation of their kingdom was Swedish. And then again, isn't it right that it was the Nazi invasion that really turbocharged this idea, because Hitler said that without the Norsemen going in, the Russians would be living like rabbits or something.
Exactly. So it's a sort of there's obviously a Germanic aspect to kind of Norse culture. They're very closely related. And so in the 20th century it became really important for Stalin to sort of say, no, we don't owe it. I think because the story is often told with kind of Viking overlords, as we'll go on to describe, Viking overlords in inverted commas civilizing the Slavic tribes. And obviously, if you are a very keen Slavophile, if you're a kind of Slav nationalist, that's very offensive, the idea that you needed to be civilized by kind of Vikings in horned helmets, which they obviously didn't wear, in their longboats and whatnot.
But of course, I mean, if you come from Britain, actually the perspective you have on the Vikings is that this civilizing process, by definition, I mean, is incredibly brutal. That acknowledging the influence that Vikings, have on 9th, 10th century Europe, whether it's in Britain or whether it's in the lands of the Dnieper and the Volga, this isn't necessarily a civilizing process. It's a process of kind of conquest and brutalization. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the really interesting thing is that these two things are happening in parallel. So everybody think when they think of the Vikings, I mean, basically pretty much every primary school in Britain, as far as I can tell, does the Vikings. At some point, kids dress up in Viking outfits and they put on horned helmets and they learn about dragon proud longboats and stuff. But they almost always study it in terms of a story that the Vikings first pitch up at Lindisfarne, they sack the monastery, and then they're constantly attacking England and France and Spain. And, Alfred burns his cakes. There are a series of battles. The Vikings said, it's all the West, and then expeditions to Greenland and Iceland. But actually, you know, a lot of Viking historians, Neil Price, for example, would say actually what the Vikings are doing in the West is a copy. They're copying what they've already started doing in the East. And it's the story in the East that is more exotic, more exciting, and also, crucially, I would say, more lucrative. There's so much money for a Viking to make sailing to the East rather than to the West. And and you could argue that in the long run, couldn't you, Tom? Creating Russia is quite a big, big
and
thing.
And Ukraine.
and Ukraine. Right. Well, the issue of which of those can lay claim, it's a bit like the argument we had in Alexander the Great podcast about Greece and Macedonia. And North Macedonia, as it's now called, fighting over the legacy of Alexander the Great, isn't it?
Yeah, because this stuff really matters.
Yeah, they both see themselves as the heirs of the Kievan Rus civilization.
Yeah, so we've the Vikings are such a great topic. I wrote about them in Millennium. I wrote about the Vikings in the East. You are writing a children's book about the Vikings right now, aren't you?
Indeed.
You're absolutely kind of immersed in this. Yeah. It's such a great topic. And we've done one episode already on the Norse epics, which essentially took us from Iceland to Greenland to Vinland and the New World. But even in Iceland, they are writing epics about what the Vikings are getting up to.
That's
in
right.
the lands of the East, going down the rivers to Baghdad, the capital of the greatest empire on the face of the earth, to Miklagard, the golden city of Caesar, Constantinople. And as you say, it's a story that is very, very thrilling. Because you have the same, you know, obviously the idea of taking ship and discovering North America, I mean, that's an incredible story. But so also is the idea that people are going from Scandinavia and kind of pitching up in Baghdad, you know, or even further afield. I mean, it is an astonishingly romantic narrative.
Well, before we get into the sort of the narrative of it, I mean, the best example of that and the one that most certainly British listeners, maybe English-speaking listeners will know, everybody knows the story of 1066, certainly in Britain they do, the Battle of Hastings, Harold and William. But obviously there's a battle before that against a guy called Harald Hardrada, who comes over from Norway to try and claim the English throne. And the life of Harald Hardrada is this whole business in microcosm.
Yeah.
You know, he had been in Norway, he ends up going to Kiev, he ends up going to Constantinople and commanding the imperial bodyguard. He may have gone to Sicily, he may have gone to the Holy Land, you know, this incredible
princess.
Well, these incredible adventures, many of which are unquestionably true because they're backed up in kind of, you know, Byzantine sources. So, I mean, you think about that life. He had a more interesting, well-traveled life than probably most of our listeners, certainly than us.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so we've got from Mary Kirk Alves, who asked very simply, why were the Vikings going east? Was it more of an expedition or a conquest? So obviously the geography of Scandinavia, kind of, you know, the ancients thought of it as an island. They didn't realize it was a peninsula. So you can take ship and go west across the North Sea or into the Baltic, up the Gulf of Finland. And beyond the Gulf of Finland lies the vast expanse, basically, of Eurasia. And the Vikings knew it as Sweden the Great, Sweden the Cold, a land of giants, of dwarves, of dragons, of men with mouths between their nipples who never spoke but only barked. So an intimidating place, but a place that, as it turns out, with incredible courage, with incredible fortitude, with incredible daring, can lead you to the richest lands on the face of the planet, the lands of the Caliphate and of the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if you think about the geography, so if you live in Norway, if you live on, you know, one of the fjords or something, when you look out, you see the North Sea and beyond it, very rich kind of farmlands of England and the monasteries of Ireland and so on. And that's the way you go. But obviously, if you live in Sweden, you're looking out east, southeast. And the first thing you see is an island called Gotland. Where have you been to Gotland, Tom?
I have. Have you?
Yeah, I have. I went there on holiday a couple of years ago. Absolutely amazing place. Beautiful island. Fantastic churches, where Rachel Morley would enjoy it. But also coin hoards. These incredible hoards of coins. Thousands and thousands of Arabic dirhams that have come up the rivers. So basically, what you would do if you were an entrepreneurial 8th century Swede, you would go to Gotland, and that's the sort of staging post where you maybe find people for your crew or you sign on with somebody. And then obviously the place to go from, I mean, you know, England or France, they're not really on your radar. what you do is you keep going across the Baltic. And there, as you say, you get the mouths of these rivers. And you know that somewhere at the end of that river is one of the richest cities on earth, Miklagard, Constantinople. And beyond it, it's all the wealth of the caliphate. And you have, I think there are two things, crucially, that you have, if you're Scandinavian, that they will buy from you. One of them is furs, which you can kind of pick up on the way. And the other, crucially, is slaves. So this is a real, a massive slave trading enterprise.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that, so how do you get there if you're in Sweden? So there's Gotland, as you say, and there's this place called Birka, which is, I think, just west of Stockholm now.
Been to Birka, Tom.
And it's as close to a town as you get in kind of early 9th century Scandinavia. And from these kind of centres, you can head eastwards up the Gulf of Finland. And there's the Volkhov River.
Yeah.
And there's a town, Staraja Ladoga.
Yeah. Staraja Ladoga, Tom.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Your Russian is shocking.
Yeah. Okay. So
that's
this is a kind of, well, it's not Wild West, is it? It's Wild East.
Well, Neil Price has a lovely thing in his book, The Children of Ashen Elm, where he says it's basically Deadwood.
So, right.
You know, it's sort of saloons. But I think a couple of people, he's not the only person to have made that American analogy, because Tom Shippey, in his book, Laughing Till I Die, about the Vikings, he has a nice section about how to answer Mary Kirk's question, it's not really like the kind of raids on Lindisfarne and stuff. He says the way to think about it is about trappers and traders in North America.
Yeah, with fur. I mean,
with fur,
the parallel is...
Exactly. Paddling down these rivers, and there are indigenous people, tribes on either side. Sometimes they'll trade with them. Sometimes they'll kind of fight each other. And and even the topography, you know, it's very heavily wooded, lots of rivers, lakes and things. So you start off in Staraja Ladoga, and you kind of... And that's kind of expanding as time goes on. I think that's found in about 750, 753 or something. And then you go south, don't you? You pick your river and
Yes, because what the Vikings are bringing is the technology that enables them to navigate these rivers. And that's evident, I think, even in the name, right? I mean, there was a message from Tapani Simajoki, friend of the show, a Finn. And he says, an interesting tidbit on the linguistics of the East Vikings and Finland as the brackish meeting point of East and West. The Finnish Sweden, Ruotsi, is probably derived from the same root as Rus, Ruslagen. And Rus, so Ruslagen, Rus is rowing.
Yeah.
Lagen is kind of the band, isn't it? So the land of the rowers. And that idea of ships going down rivers, people rowing, often against the current, with the current. And the ships are sufficiently, you know, they're built so that they can negotiate quite shallow waters, and they're sufficiently light that, you know, you get to a lake, you need to go across to the head of a river, you can carry the ship.
Yeah, but that's where the slaves come in very handy. So this constant issue of the portage, I think, is the technical term, where you basically, you get to the end of your bit of river, or you get to the point where you need to cross over, and basically you need to be able to get out, either semi-dismantle your ship, or the ship is light enough to for you to carry it.
Or your slaves to carry it.
Or your slaves. Well, this is where the slaves, basically your cargo, are carrying it for you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sort of genius, if you like, the sort of horrific genius of the business model. That you're trading human beings who are doing a lot of the work for you.
And so obviously there's incredibly, you know, you're very vulnerable if you're having to carry a ship, you know, up mountains and, you know, where the rapids are, or, you know, through forests or whatever. So you're very vulnerable. And so that's why along the length of these lakes, these rivers, at certain key points, you start to get more and more kind of forts, really. So Novgorod, I mean, you're the Russian speaker here, Dominic. That means new fort, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that appears on Lake Ilmen.
That's right. And they called it Holmgard, I think, didn't they? The Rus themselves, the little fort. And it's sort of, I think a lot of these forts are kind of very North American style. They're kind of made of logs, aren't they?
So everything in Novgorod is made of wood.
Yeah.
Everything. Even the kind of, you know, rather than paper, they're writing on kind of bark and things.
To answer, go back to Mary Kirk's question, is it a conquest? I don't think they think of it as a conquest because they're not interested in, you know, it's not a risk where they're interested in kind of capturing lots of land. What they're interested in is the route, is the river, and making money. And yeah. They establish the forts as kind of trading stations, basically. And you can imagine the kind of, I think Neil Price in his book has a little stuff about, you know, the scene, people drinking, probably lots of crime.
Tinkling on the piano.
sassy madams.
Sassy bar tarts. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but that's the sort of atmosphere. And obviously that's quite cosmopolitan in the sense that there are lots of these Scandinavians who are mostly, I think, Swedes, because that's obviously where you come from. But there are also undoubtedly at this stage lots of Slavs. So even at this stage, I think you've got the mix that becomes Russia, the mix of Scandinavian and Slav.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Novgorod is it's a place. I mean, it's very like a kind of Western. So you get lots of celebrated figures in the Norse epics. You know, when they're down on their luck, they go there and they kind of recruit men, you know, people to go off. To Britain or, you know, attack Denmark or whatever. But at the same time, obviously, from Novgorod, you can cross the lake and you can then either get the Dnieper, which will take you down to the Black Sea, and from the Black Sea to Constantinople, Miklagard, the great city, or to the Volga, which will take you to the Caspian Sea, and from the Caspian Sea to Baghdad or to lands even kind of, you know, in Central Asia, the Silk Road, and so on.
They attack Azerbaijan at one point. Maybe we'll come to that later.
Kind of incredible. So Novgorod is the kind of, I guess, the meeting point of Scandinavia, Dnieper, and the Volga.
And if you're going the sort of the western route, as it were, the route down to Miklagard, the next stop is what becomes Smolensk. So, I mean, these are, you know, if you think of a lot of kind of well-known Western Russian towns and cities, they have routes along this kind of route, or indeed even further east along the Volga. So the Smolensk is a place called, seems to be begun as a place called Nezdovo, and that's the confluence of the Dnieper and the Svinets River. And again, you know, it's the same sort of Wild West kind of atmosphere, but it's like the tension is rising because you're about to approach, as you keep going south, you're going to approach these rapids, these very exciting rapids that bizarrely we know about from this incredible source. You must have tons
a Byzantine
of stuff like
emperor, no less.
Yeah, who wrote a handbook.
Yes, for his son, Constantine VII. So
Porphyrogenitus. He writes a foreign policy guide for his son, Romanus. Basically, this is how you handle all our neighbors. I mean, just an incredible kind of almost like a policy document to have survived. And in it, he says, so, you know, the Rus, well, this is the deal with them. And he basically explains, sets out the whole of the route. So he says they have these special boats called, what are they called? Monoxala, single keel boats. So they're basically, he says at this point, they're in kind of disposable boats, kind of little kind of dugout canoes. They all go together in a big flotilla, he says. And by this point, you're in what is now Ukraine. So you're going down the river through the center of what's now Ukraine. And the river's only navigable in the summer. And basically you keep having to get out. And as the rapids approach, the slaves will carry your boats for you. And the rapids all have excellent names. Do you know all the names of these rapids?
Yeah, they're terrifying, aren't they? And there's one of them appears on an inscription actually in Gotland, I think.
Does it? Mm. I didn't know that. One of them's called the Drinker. Esupi, the Drinker. Gelandri, the Yeller. Ifor, the ever fierce, Leanti, the laugher, so on and so forth. So they're sort of these weird names for all these different rapids, and they navigate all them. But by the point at which they're coming down, they're coming close to what are more like states and kind of confederations of tribes.
Pechenegs.
So there's the Pechenegs.
Who are terrifying.
They're kind of nomad. They've just vanished from history now, haven't they? I don't know. I mean, I think they became Tatars or something, but they.
But you wouldn't want to be caught by them.
They're nomads. Ship. Well, they will They'll cut your head off, and they will make it into a goblet, won't they? Don't they do that later? As we'll discover later in the show,
it's
they
very,
do
very
too?
Blood Meridian.
So they'll do that, and there's also the Khazars, who are incredibly interesting.
Yes, yes. So they are further east, and they're basically a kind of buffer between the Slavs and the Caliphate. So they're nomadic Turkic people, but they amazingly convert to Judaism, which is a distinctive thing to do.
Well, they're the world's only Jewish state, aren't they? Between the Roman takeover of the Holy Land and the establishment of the State of Israel in the late 1940s. I mean, which is just an incredible thing to be. And why did they pick Judaism, Tom?
Well, the story is, and this again will turn up later when we talk about the conversion of Kiev to Christianity. The leader of the Khazars sends messages to all the various powers to send him a Christian monk, a Jewish rabbi, a Muslim scholar to go and persuade him. And it's the Jewish, it's the rabbi who wins out. And this was the subject of a fabulous novel, I think written in early 80s by a guy called Milorad Pavic, a Serbian novelist called Dictionary of the Khazars, which is it's kind of a magical realist novel. Very good. I highly recommend it. And so the Khazars seem to, in a weird way, have become Jewish.
But it sort of makes sense, right? Because they're stuck between two rival powers.
Yeah, a Christian and a Muslim empire.
Yeah. So they're, so, whichever they, where they jump, they're doomed. So they jump a third way and it kind of works for them.
And I think that to begin with, the it's the caliphate that is really the focus of the energies of the Rus rather than Byzantium, because it's... it's an absolute, you know, we've got lots of questions about silver. So Stefan Jensen, himself a Viking, why are there such enormous amounts of Arabian silver coins in Viking graves across Scandinavia? It's the volume of silver that is really attracting them. And so to begin with, I think that, you know, they're going down the Volga much more than they're going down towards the Black Sea. So they're going towards the Caspian. So they have to negotiate with the Khazars. And some of them definitely do seem to have ended up in Baghdad.
Well, they're drawn by the silver, but also by the slave markets, right? There's an inexhaustible demand for slaves in Baghdad.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, obviously they are bringing slaves who are Slavs, but they also may well be bringing slaves that they've captured in some of their other raids further north. So there are lots of children's books. I mean, there's a wonderful book by Rosemary Sutcliffe called Blood Feud, where it's the story of a boy, I think it is, who is captured in Wessex. They take him to Dublin, to the great slave markets there, and he ends up, one way or another, he ends up going down the rivers and he ends up in Constantinople. But obviously he could have ended up in Baghdad. And, you know, it's not impossible by any means to think of quite a lot of, you know, substantial number of possibly Scandinavians themselves, English, Franks, Irish, Slavs going down all that way.
Well, I think it is mainly Slavs. And the evidence for that is obviously the fact that we have the word slave. I mean, it's absolutely imprinted on the English language and many other European languages as well. Have you read, have come across Michael McCormick's book, Origins of the European Economy?
I haven't.
It's a really, I mean, it's a massive book. And his argument essentially is that the caliphate in all, you know, so not just the Abbasid caliphate, but the Muslim lands of North Africa and Spain as well, are so economically advanced ahead of Europe that all that Europe can provide really is slaves. And so the main provider of slaves is Otto the Great, for instance, friend of the show. So he is, you know, they are harvesting vast, vast numbers of Slavs and they're being transported through Europe, down through Spain to North Africa. What the Vikings are doing is that they are going to the richest, you know, the heartland of the Islamic world and going to Baghdad. And it's that opens up, you know, the vast kind of stream of silver that they're then able to bring back. Yeah. And it's really that explains the rhythms of Viking campaigns in the West as well, because it's when the silver mines in Yemen and in Central Asia dry up that they then start to refocus their attention on England, which by this point also has a kind of very silver-based economy.
Yeah, and also because it's easier in some ways. I mean, if you can get silver flooding in, that's more immediate than getting land. I mean, land is great in England if you can get it. But you're right. I think we have to see the East and Western things sort of in parallel. That obviously, whenever that Eastern route is kind of cut off for some reason, or there's a diminution in the trade, then you see a kind of intensification of the sort of Western attacks. Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
Well, but it's just so you get that the Samanid emirs in Central Asia discover these vast silver mines, I think in kind of 890s, so end of the 9th century. And over the first half of the 10th century, silver is flooding in from there. And that, of course, is the period where in the West, you know, the English state is able to construct itself,
yeah.
The fight back against the Vikings.
So Alfred and his successors.
Presumably because, actually, there's so much money to be made in the East that becomes the main focus of attention.
Yeah.
And then after about 965, the silver mines in the East dry up. And so Birka gets abandoned towards the end of the 10th century. And you start to get Vikings moving back towards England, Ethelred the Unready and Svein Forkbeard and so on. So I think it's really fascinating. I mean, we tend not to think of that, you know, the rhythms of the emergence of the English state and then the return of the Vikings to a degree is being conditioned by the availability of silver in the East.
Okay, we'll just take a quick break, Tom, and we'll come back after the ads. Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking about the Vikings in the East, and we've got all kinds of, gruesome stuff to come. Now, talking of gruesome stuff, Tom, we are very responsive, as the public know, to popular opinion.
We're the People's Podcast, aren't we?
We are the People's Podcast. Now, last week, we released two podcasts about the trial and execution of Charles I, and they provoked a remarkably intense reaction. Did you see some of the
dare one say intemperate?
I don't know whether intemperate is the word. robust, some would say.
I would say that the robust in response came from one person in particular, who we actually name checked at the start of the episode, Capel Loft, who had already got cross with us during the World Cup of Kings and Queens because we hadn't included Charles I in our list.
He had form. He had started his own rival World Cup, I believe.
Yes, in which Charles I did very well.
Yeah, because he rigged the tournament.
Yes, he did. Very Stuart behaviour.
Very Stuart behaviour.
Anyway, so Capel Loft responded to our episodes by saying, and this was a tweet he put out, just made a second attempt to listen to The Rest is History on the trial of Charles, King and Martyr, but once again had to stop in anger every lazy bit of long since debunked Puritan and Whig propaganda is trotted out without challenge. Falsehood and half-truth abound. Vile.
Vile. I mean, that's strong. So there was then a huge discussion. So I went to bed having just seen that and got up the next morning to discover about several hundred messages, people attacking each other about Charles I. So Ted Valance, Professor Ted Valance, who I've known for 29 years, was our guest. I knew him when he was a teenager, would you believe? And Capel Loft said to me, "It pains me that as a fan of Baldwin and Joseph Chamberlain, you can be so wrong on 17th century politics, though at least you're not quite as dead to all morality and decency as that hellhound Valance." So, I mean, to be fair, he's nailed Ted pretty well.
He is a hellhound. He is.
So anyway.
But Dominic, Tom. I mean, we've done podcasts and all kinds of things. We've done fascism and communism and Mohammed and all kinds of stuff. And who would have thought that it would be the character of Charles I that would...
Charles King and Martyr, as Capel Loft calls him.
So anyway, this is by way of saying that because we are the People's Podcast and because we are responsive to deeply held beliefs, we have invited Capel Loft onto the members podcast that goes out to the Wangs, as we like to call them, the members of the Rest of History Special Club. And that will be going out tomorrow, Tuesday.
Well, indeed. So if you're a member, you've got that to look forward to. And we'll be debating with him about our treatment of Charles I and what he sees, I think, as the cancer of Whiggery that has eaten into the Rest is History. If you're not a member of the Rest is History Club, this is your opportunity, basically. You know, you don't want to miss out on the big fight.
It's massive.
Yeah.
It's the big sports event of 2022 so far. And you can sign up to that on restishistorypod.com.
Excellent. So back to the Vikings.
Who were not Whigs.
Definitely not Whigs. Definitely immune from the taint of Whiggery, I would say, the Vikings. Not
possibly even more immune to the taint of Whiggery than Capel Loft. And that is saying something.
So one last question on this issue of contacts with Baghdad, Tom. Diogo Morgado has an excellent question. Vikings and Arabs, clash of civilizations or trade-based contact? Did Islam have any influence in the decline of Norse polytheism? Well, I don't have an answer to the second half. The first half, I would say, not really a clash of civilizations. I mean, we have some really, really interesting things written by Arabs about the Norse and saying, you know, they're very dirty or they have weird customs and so on. Maybe we'll come to that. But I would say it's more trade, fascination, exchange and so on. But you'll have your own answer. What do you think?
Well, I think the question of whether visitors to the caliphate, you know, are influenced by Muslim, do some of them become Muslim? Do they bring Muslim brides back? I mean, the evidence. So there's the grave of a woman in Sweden was found who had a ring with kind of invocation of Allah.
Yes.
On the ring.
Yeah.
And various textiles have been found, again, with kind of Quranic phrases woven into it. The woman herself seems to have come from the Islamic world. Whether the fact that you have Quranic messages on your robes means that you've become a Muslim, I'm not sure about that.
Say it's surely unlikely. Surely it's just luxurious.
Well, because famously also there's a Buddha was found, wasn't it, in a grave. And that doesn't imply they're Buddhists. And they're kind of the crozier from Ireland. They're basically kind of garnering loot. But I would have thought it wasn't beyond the bounds of possibility that the caliphs were kind of sending missionaries to try and convert at least some of these barbarians. That's what they were doing. So who knows? Who knows? It's a very kind of interesting question.
But Tom, that raises a really, really interesting set of stories. So we do know that there are lots of people who are, you know, Arabs and or Arab messengers, envoys and so on. Ibn Rusta, for example, Miskawaya. That I'm sure my Arabic's not quite that good. Ibn Kurudabhib. And apologies to listeners for Tom doesn't have the courage to do these fantastic Arabic voices, but I do. But the most famous one is Ibn Fadlan. So Ibn Fadlan this is the story that basically anyone who's interested in the Vikings in the East is familiar with. He is an envoy stroke missionary who is sent by the Abbasid Caliph al-Muqtadir to go to the Volga, to the people who live on the Volga, who are Turkic people called the Bulgars. So they're not the kind of Slav Bulgarians that we think of now. They're living on the Volga in what's now Tatarstan. And Ibn Fadlan has been sent there basically as a diplomat, stroke missionary, to build him a mosque. And when he gets there, he finds a load of Vikings.
Vikings, yeah.
And he's quite struck by them, isn't he? I mean, he's quite impressed by them. He says they're as tall as date palms, blonde and ruddy. And he's very impressed they've got by their weapons and their kit and stuff.
But he's also, they are the filthiest of Allah's creatures. They do not wash after shitting or peeing, nor after sexual intercourse, and do not wash after eating. They are like wayward donkeys.
Yeah. So he sort of thinks of them in a very, you know, they're barbarians, basically, to him, aren't they? They are, in a kind of weird way, noble savages, I suppose. Impressive, tall, strong, self-confident and so on, but also weird and a bit unsettling. And he's obviously a really interesting guy because he's curious. So he says he hears that one of their chiefs has died.
Yeah.
And they're going to have this massive funeral. He's like, oh, can I come and... He makes the worst decision of his life.
No, it's an amazing decision.
He says, so, I'd like to come and watch.
Yes. In Baghdad, when the Vikings turn up, they pretend to be Christian, and they have to do that because if you're a follower of the book, then you can get in by paying a kind of tax. Whereas if you're a pagan, you can't. The thing that's interesting about this burial is that it's unapologetically pagan. You know, there's no pretense about it being Christian whatsoever. And the fascination of that for archaeologists is, you know, when they dig up the ship burials or whatever, and they find kind of various dismembered animals and the skeletons of women and things inside it. It's very difficult. You know, you've got the hardware, but you don't have the software. Ibn Fidlan's account provides the software that otherwise we simply wouldn't have.
Yeah. And also he provides quite good ammunition for people who say when these guys went east, they were still very much Scandinavians because this is a Scandinavian, an identifiable Scandinavian funeral ritual that is taking place, I mean, God knows how many hundreds of miles away on the Volga in what is now the absolute kind of Russian heartland. And he, how long does it take, Tom? Does it take 10 days, doesn't it? It takes 10 days to get ready for this funeral. I mean, it is the most colossal blowout, basically.
Presided over by a sinister old woman called the Angel of Death.
I saw she was a witch, thick-bodied and sinister. It's a Sibyl Fadlan. He's fattest, unfortunately.
And barbarianist.
Yeah, he's not impressed by the Angel of Death at all. I mean, frankly, with your name like that, you're asking for... disobliging commentary.
You wouldn't want, I think, to be a female slave in the vicinity of the Angel of Death, because
you wouldn't. That is for sure.
So someone has to accompany the dead Viking chief to the afterlife, and so they ask for a volunteer. And actually, interest doesn't have to be a woman. It could be a slave boy as well. But it's a girl who volunteers.
So they've lined them all up, haven't they? And there's people. So the guy's ship has been propped up on the shore with wood.
Yeah, his kind of half buried. Is that right?
I think something like that. Is it half buried?
So it's half kind of they've heaped earth over half of it, so that you then go in.
That's right. Yes,
but the other half is outside.
They've divvied up the dead guy's fortune three ways. So a third of it is spent on booze, unbelievably.
Which is great, isn't it?
A third of it is spent
like kind of death duties
on special kind of funeral gear, so on other funeral stuff like his burial clothes, and then the remaining third is split up among his heirs, basically. So they've, there's this massive kind of festival atmosphere, and they get the slaves together and they say, which of you volunteers? And Ibn Fadlan watches, kind of fascinated. He's got an interpreter with him who's explaining what's going on, and this girl steps forward. She's teenager, I think it's pretty clear she's a teenager. Whether she is coerced or whether she steps forward voluntarily is unclear, I would say. Tom,
she having volunteered, she's then treated like a kind of princess, and she gets given slaves.
She has clothes and jewels, and
she gets
all
clothes
sorts.
And jewels, and she gets given kind of drugs, I think. And there's kind of weird thing where she goes to something that looks like a door frame.
That's on the last day, isn't it?
Yeah.
So on the last day, the 10th day, they set up a sort of a bed on the deck of the boat with this guy's, presumably by now,
in quite
putrid, rank, rotting corpse in bed, dressed in these fancy clothes. And they lay out a huge feast around his body. Then they bring out the girl. The girl by now has been, clearly she's been very heavily drugged and given booze and stuff. Then they bring a dog to the ship, and they cut the dog in half. And they throw both halves of the dog on board. I mean, so strange. They put all the guy's weapons in the cabin. They tear the heads off some chickens.
Yeah.
Ibn Fadlan at this point is thinking, God, this was a very bad decision this funeral.
The door frame.
Yeah, they lift her up.
They lift her up, and she says she can see her father and her mother. Then they lift her up again, and she sees all her family. And then the third time she says that she sees her master in the afterworld, and it's green and it's beautiful, and there are all kinds of men.
Then they take off her jewels, and she walks onto the deck of the ship. But this is a weird detail. She walks on the raised palms, so she's being held up in a sort of, you know, mosh pit style scenario. They hoist her onto the ship. She sings a leave-taking song, and then they make her drink two big kind of flasks of beer, I assume, or something. And then at this point, so Ibn Fadlan, at this point, his story, which is pretty dark, becomes genuinely very dark, because he says at this point she's confused and she's crying out and she doesn't want to carry on or whatever. But the angel,
too late.
Yeah, the angel of death at this point grabs her and sort of they drag her into a little cabin. At this point, everybody's outside.
They're all
drumming.
Beating on their shields.
Beating on their shields. It's such a terrible scene.
To drown out the screams.
Right.
That she's giving.
And then four of the men hold her down, and two others strangle her while the Angel of Death is stabbing her with a knife. Ibn Fadlan is watching all this, and one of the guys standing next to him says, God, you have terrible rituals in the Caliphate, don't you? I mean, compared with this is brilliant. You must be absolutely, and you can sort of tell from his account that he's thinking, this is pretty awful.
Yeah.
It's a really weird, I think it's so weird, isn't it? It's such a weird story. And it's sort of you get this so much from Neil Price's books, that our image of kind of Viking religion is all very kind of jolly. And it's kind of Thor and his hammer and Odin and all this stuff. But this is the darkness.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, all the main gods are kind of terrifyingly phallic.
Yeah, but the way in which it's portrayed to children, Tom, and the way it's presented, Comics version of Norse mythology.
But Thor is a serial rapist. The hammer is obviously very phallic.
Yeah.
Odin is always raping. Frey, I mean, he has, you know, the statue of him at Uppsala in Sweden. He has an absolutely enormous phallus. It's unsettling, I think.
And this story is incredibly, I mean, it's unbelievably rich and interesting for historians, archaeologists, anthropologists, and so on, because it makes sense of a lot of the burials that you find.
All those kind of dismembered corpses of animals.
Exactly. And the weird things you find. But it gives you a sense of, you know, this sort of the jolly adventure story in Rosemary Sutcliffe kind of way, in which so many of these Viking stories are told, actually misses out just how cruel and violent a world and strange and unsettling a world it was. Anyway.
Well, I think what I'm going to say now, that
it's about cricket.
The conversion of the Vikings to Christianity is, it removes them from a world that I think to us is unimaginably strange.
Yeah.
Because we remain in the kind of the moral, ethical world that Christianity gave us. Islam as well. I mean, Ibn Fadlan's sense of kind of the sense of the strangeness and the horror of it is to that extent ours. And that world to us, I think, is very, very remote and difficult and strange and weird. And so the process by which the Rus end up becoming Christian is very, very kind of important. As that passage from Putin that I read at the start of this episode. Okay, well, I think that that's enough for today's episode. And clearly we thought we were going to get all this done in one episode. We're not. I think that tomorrow we should go to the Dnieper, we should go to the founding of Kiev, we should look at, in a bit more detail, the relationship of the Rus to Constantinople and the process by which the Kievan Rus became Christian. So we will see you back tomorrow.
Bye.